It's to the best of our knowledge. I'm Anne Strainchamps.
My dad, when he was a little boy, had all of the original hardcover Oz books. So when I was a kid growing up, those were the first books that I reached for.
Editor Anne Vandermeer.
People, when they think of Oz, they think of the Wizard of Oz, the first book. But they don't know about Ozma of Oz. There were all these other strange and unusual but loving characters. It was just amazing to me. And here's Dorothy having all these adventures, but not just Dorothy. There was all kinds of warring factions and royalty, but it was mainly just regular people just trying to get through their day. That was the thing that really struck me about the characters in Oz, and sometimes it was a talking chicken. I don't know what it is about me and chickens, but I love them so much, and I think it probably started with Oz. During the time period that I first came across those books, my parents had gone through a really horrible divorce. And my dad left those books behind. When I became an editor and started editing that type of work, that's what really brought my dad and me back together. My dad had always wanted to be a writer, but he ended up going to medical school and he became a doctor instead. And everything that I did, every book project that I worked on, I always had him in the back of my mind. My dad recently passed away last summer, and when I went with my sisters and we were looking through all of his different papers and things like that, we were surprised to find so much poetry and short little fiction things. And I had no idea that he was still writing. So that was quite a discovery for us to see, and we just sat around reading everything that he wrote. And it just meant a lot to me that we were able to reconnect through fiction.
Anne Vandermeer is an award-winning editor and publisher of Weird Fiction. And that makes her an authority on story worlds, which is our topic this hour. World building, that magic trick writers do of creating a whole fictional world for characters to live in. Places like Oz, or Westeros, or Planet of the Apes. And writers do this all the time. This hour, George Saunders will tell us how he created a graveyard afterlife for Abraham Lincoln's son, Willie. Mark Frost will talk about inventing a surreal little town called Twin Peaks. But first, let's get Anne Vandermeer to explain the craft of building a completely imaginary, fantastic, fictional world.
I do believe that there's more of a responsibility on the fantasy or the science fiction writer because you can't take as much for granted. You really need to know the world that you're building. Even if you don't put it all on the page, you need to know it well enough. And then you also have to balance between what you're going to share with the reader and what you hold back, because what you don't want to end up doing is you don't want to end up going on page after page after page explaining this gadget. You know, when you're reading realistic fiction and one of your characters picks up a telephone, you don't have to explain it. Everyone knows what a telephone is. Mm-hmm. But when you're talking about some kind of other world and they have a different way of communicating and they're picking up whatever that gadget is, you don't want to have to explain everything. So the other thing that you have to consider is what you're doing is you're giving them a view of this world, but it's through your characters. So you have two things that you're dealing with when you're building these worlds. You're dealing with the world view, which is the entire world that you've created, but then you're also dealing with the story view, which is what the character sees.
Fantasy or story world fiction often tends to get kind of lumped into genre fiction or just entertainment fiction, but there is a more literary aspect of some of that work too. And I wanted to ask you about one particular writer I just came across. You and your husband, Jeff Vandermeer, just published a big collection from a Finnish writer named Lina Krohn.
Yes.
I'd never encountered her before.
Oh my gosh, she's so amazing. She is really quite something. And the way that she approaches fiction, I mean, she has this I don't know how to explain her mind, but she's mixing nature and mathematics and science and relationships and biology. And she's unique. And she is a national treasure in Finland, and she should be more well-regarded and more known here in this country, I feel. And I just think that if more people actually read her fiction, they would just be bowled over by what she can do.
For example, there's a story, I don't know how you say it, Taneran?
Taneran, which is my favorite of all of her work.
Okay, tell us about Taneran.
Okay, the beauty of Taneran is that the story is told from the point of view of a tourist. And sometimes the best way to tell the story of a different world is through the point of view of a tourist, because the tourist is going to notice everything that's weird and different, whereas a person inside the culture is not going to remark on it because it's part of their daily lives. So here is this tourist, and you don't really know very much about them, but they are visiting Taneran, okay, which happens to be a world where insects are the population, all different kinds of insects. So the tourist is there for a while. We don't know why. We don't know where they're from, but they're writing letters back home. So every chapter in Taneran is a letter back home, and we don't even know who the person is that they're writing the letters to. But of course, as they're writing the letters, they're describing what's going on to them as they're in this world, even though the entire population of this world that the tourist is visiting are insects. They're still communicating with the tourist, but they're still behaving like the insects that they are. The way that she describes them and the actions that they take, they're still true to their insect personalities, but at the same time, they're talking and going about their daily lives as if they were regular people like we understand. And so I think that that's the beauty of that. And she remarks on different things through the tourists writing these letters back home. It's just an amazing book. Okay, so this is the eighth letter, Their Innumerable Dwellings. The Taneranians' way of life is a very curious one. You will perhaps not have heard that they often have a number of dwellings, but not only in the way that we have city apartments and summer villas, no. The people here are able to live in many dwellings at the same time, as in a nest of boxes. Some of them carry their innermost apartment, a one-room flat which fits their dimensions like a glove, with them everywhere. But this has the drawback that one cannot always make sense of what they say, for it echoes and reverberates from the walls of their private apartments. It is also vexing to me that I cannot always tell where the dwelling ends and its inhabitant begins. Poor things, who never come among people without this innermost shield. It reflects the terrible vulnerability of their lives. Their little home may be made of the most diverse ingredients, grains of sand, bark, straw, clay, leaves, but it protects them better than others that are protected by armor from every direction, and it is a direct continuation of themselves, much more so than clothes are to you or me. But if it is taken away from them, they die, perhaps simply of shame, perhaps because their skins are too soft for the outside air, or because they do not have any skin at all. Who would be so cruel as to tear from them this last shield? Oh, I have heard that such things, too, happen here in Taneran. I have been startled by the moans of the death throes in the depths of the night.
Wow.
See?
Yes. Yes.
Amazing.
It's about insects and it's about us.
Yes.
You can't hear or read that without recognizing that feeling, you know, of feeling that you're wanting to hide yourself and how horrible it feels if somebody rips away your protective coating.
And then you're exposed.
And Anne Vandermeer. She's an editor and a publisher, and she and her husband, writer Jeff Vandermeer, also run Shared Worlds. It's a summer writing program for teens. You'll find more information on our website at ttbook.org. Coming up, we'll explore the secret history of one of television's most enduring fictional universes, Twin Peaks, home to some damn fine coffee.
Damn good coffee.
And a woman who carries a small log in her arms. Plus, this year's Booker Prize winner, George Saunders, on the haunting story world of his debut novel, Lincoln in the Bardo.
She yips and yips and must always be first in all things. How? Please tell me, does she merit such...
You could learn a thing or two from her, Mrs. Blass. Look at her posture.
How calm she remains.
How clean her clothing is kept.
I'm Anne Strainchamps. This is To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRX.
You say drink coffee, I'll drink coffee.
Cup of coffee.
Cup of coffee, please.
I was wondering if I might trouble you for a cup of strong black coffee.
Fellas, don't drink that coffee. Damn good coffee.
They do like their coffee in Twin Peaks. That's a montage of caffeinated clips from the TV series. Twin Peaks aired for just two seasons, beginning around April 1990. This year, 27 years later, it came back for a brand new season. Show creator Mark Frost also came out with a Twin Peaks backstory this year, The Secret History of Twin Peaks. It's a novel structured as a secret dossier compiled by a mysterious archivist and annotated by an FBI agent. It includes undiscovered diary entries from Lewis and Clark, newspaper articles from the Twin Peaks Gazette, and even the menu from the Double R Diner, where pies go to die. Doug Gordon sat down with Mark Frost to find out more.
There was a desire to just simply participate in some way in this world that we had created. It really was, I guess, what we'd now routinely call world building.
Yeah.
At a very fundamental level. And the place that we created had this advantage of feeling profoundly familiar on some levels and also deeply strange.
Yeah.
So that there was an alignment of the mundane and the macabre. And I can't tell you how many people I've subsequently met who really want to live in this world. Dozens of people who actually moved up to the towns that we shot the show in all those years ago and went back to shoot in last year. That it was just simply something they felt a kinship to and were drawn to in a mysterious way. So the whole thing has a very strong sense of mystery to it. At a certain point, you just have to stand back and say, wow, this is really something.
It definitely is. Mark, now would be a great time to have you read an excerpt from The Secret History of Twin Peaks. I was thinking about the eulogy that the log lady reads at a memorial service. And if you could set it up, that would be great.
A dear friend of the log ladies and many people in town has passed away. They've had a memorial service on the shores of Pearl Lake. And at the end of the service, Margaret stands up to speak on behalf of her friend, and the notes in the book that are jotted down by the deceased's brother are the only record we have of what Margaret said, and this is his account. Margaret holds her log and looks around, really looks, for some time before speaking. This is now. And now will never be again. Blue sky, cool air, and green, green forests. Mountains, lakes, and streams. The wind, water, earth, air and fire, red, yellow, purple and white. We come from the elemental and return to it. There is change, but nothing is lost. There is much we cannot see, air, for instance, most of the time. But knowing our next breath will follow our last without fail is an act of faith, is it not? Dark times will always come as night follows day. A dark age will test us all, each and every one. Trust and do not tremble in the face of the unknown. It shall not remain unknown to you for long. Robert knows this now, as will we all in the sweet by and by.
That was great. Thank you, Mark.
Thank you. I come from a long line of hams.
Yeah, and it's working for you. In the opening statement of your novel, The Archivist talks about the difference between mystery and secrets, and it seems to me that mystery and secrets are two of the major themes in both the Twin Peaks TV series and your novel. What do you think?
I would agree with that. I would say that the idea of mystery is something that is profoundly inherent in all of reality. It's a Joseph Campbell mystery as opposed to a murder mystery. It's a sense that there's something going on just beneath the surface of what we can perceive. It's really what people talk about, I guess, when they're talking about a spiritual sense of reality, that there's something evanescent and hard to grasp and very often seems just beyond our reach. But there are times in our lives when we catch glimpses of it.
Yeah. And UFOs, unidentified flying objects, also come up on more than one occasion. And why did you want to include so much UFO content?
Number one, we had dealt with it in a very particular and specific way in the second season of the show. So
right.
there was ground for it. Number two, it becomes a kind of stand-in for this idea of the mysterious experience. And as I delved pretty deep into UFO history, you quickly realize this is a phenomenon that goes back not just hundreds, but literally thousands of years. There's this very strange tradition in human storytelling of people being confronted or abducted or meeting beings that they have no explanation for understanding. I cite an example from the Bible that Ezekiel in the Old Testament sees this flaming chariot in the sky and talks of meeting these giants, the Elohim. It's a whole book of the Bible. Well, that's pretty weird.
That is very weird, yeah.
And then I uncovered in the 19th century, there were a huge string of accounts of people all over the West and the Midwest seeing what they described as giant airships floating across the sky. Now, this is well before the Wright brothers had ever been up there. But these stories are legion, and not all of them have been debunked. It's a mysterious and persistent part of human existence. And it's not just in our culture. It appears to be fairly universal.
You mentioned that what we call the UFO experience, it raises the question in my mind, should we have a different name for it? Like, what would you call this if, you know, going further back, pre the Wright brothers and things, should we come up with some sort of name to describe this kind of experience?
Well, I mean, in the 19th century in England, they called it the spirit world. They called it encounters with fairies or elves. Or in Germany, they were kobolds or trolls or dwarves that lived in the mountains. Even when we were up in Washington filming, we were out in some Native people land, and Michael Horse, who's a member of the cast and a Native American himself, took me aside and said that the Native people had told him one of the forests where we were shooting was where the little people showed up. So this idea is persistent. We Americans have a tendency to think we know everything because we have a lot of knowledge.
Yeah.
But there's different kinds of knowledge.
You also weave conspiracy theories into the secret history of Twin Peaks very artfully, and these conspiracy theories really add to the narrative drive of your story. Why do you think we're so drawn to conspiracy theories?
Well, I've thought about this a lot because, you know, I was 10 years old when JFK was shot. He was buried on my 10th birthday.
Huh.
And for 4 years, I was obsessed with getting to the bottom of this. And there's a whole worldwide industry on who killed JFK, that it became a kind of alternate way of looking at the world. And that was the first time when I was ever really particularly aware that we didn't just have to depend on conventional or authoritative voices, that there were perhaps other ways of viewing it. I think a lot of conspiracy theories arise out of the notion that something as momentous as, say, the murder of a young and vigorous and shining example of American political history could be taken out by somebody as small and as insignificant and as stupid as a Lee Harvey Oswald. So that gave rise to this idea, but it can't have been him.
Yeah.
It had to have been something more momentous. It had to have been something that ran much deeper.
That it can't be random. There's got to be some underlying meaning. It's kind of a just a sort of the way our minds are wired, right, to detect these patterns and make sense of the world.
Exactly. Once that gets started, once the ball gets rolling, it's pretty hard to stop.
Yeah, definitely. Final question. What do you think is the legacy of Twin Peaks, the television series?
Boy, it's a hard one for me to answer because other than that it touched in some way on some kind of truth that spoke to a lot of people. If you work creatively for a living, sure, you want to entertain people and you want to make them laugh and you want to make them cry and you want to tell them a story that keeps them on the edge of their seat. But to go back to the Joseph Campbell idea of the function of a storyteller in a culture is that it's our job to keep mythology alive for people. It's akin to what shamans did in first world cultures. They kept alive the mysteries of the past, and that somehow enlivened the present. And I like to think that at its best, that's what storytellers do for our culture now.
Mark Frost is the author of The Secret History of Twin Peaks. He's the co-creator, along with David Lynch, of the TV series. The third season of Twin Peaks debuted in May. This year's Booker Prize went to George Saunders for Lincoln in the Bardo, his complex, multi-character novel set during the Civil War. President Abraham Lincoln's beloved son, Willie, dies, probably of typhoid fever. He's only 11 years old. Lincoln is overcome with grief and visits the cemetery crypt many times to hold his boy's body. Steve Paulson talked with George Saunders when the book first came out, and they began with a reading.
Can you explain what's going on in this scene?
Yeah, there's a convention in the book that when a ghost sort of co-inhabits the same space as a living person, the ghost gets a kind of temporary omniscience. The person's thought stream becomes fully available to the ghost. So there, Lincoln has entered the tomb, and Willie is kind of watching Lincoln fuss over the physical body. And the spirit of Willie, who's separate, is kind of feeling a little jealous. And so he kind of just plunges into Lincoln and thereby gets access to Lincoln's thoughts and feelings in that moment. Chapter 21. Mouth at the worm's ear, Father said, "We have loved each other well, dear Willie, but now, for reasons we cannot understand, that bond has been broken. But our bond can never be broken. As long as I live, you will always be with me, child." Then let out a sob. Dear Father, crying, that was hard to see. And no matter how I patted and kissed and made to console, it did no... "You were a joy," he said. "Please know that. Know that you were a joy to us. Every minute, every season, you were... You did a good job. A good job of being a pleasure to know. Saying all this to the worm. How I wished him to say it to me, and to feel his eyes on me. So I thought, all right, by Jim, I will get him to see me. And in I went. It was no bother at all. Say, it felt all right, like I somewhat belonged in there, held so tight, I was now partly also in Father, and could know exactly what he was, could feel the way his long legs lay, how it is to have a beard, taste coffee in the mouth, and though not thinking in words exactly, knew that the feel of him in my arms has done me good. It has. Is this wrong? Unholy? No, he is mine. He is ours, and therefore I must be, in that sense, a god in this. Where he is concerned, I may decide what is best. And I believe this has done me good. I remember him again, who he was. I had forgotten somewhat already, but here, his exact proportions, his suit smelling of him still, his forelock between my fingers, the heft of him familiar from when he would fall asleep in the parlor, and I would carry him up to... It has done me good. I believe it has. It is secret. A bit of secret weakness that shores me up. In shoring me up, it makes it more likely that I shall do my duty in other matters. It hastens the end of this period of weakness. It harms no one. Therefore, it is not wrong, and I shall take away from here this resolve. I may return as often as I like, telling no one, accepting whatever help it may bring me, until it helps me no more. Then Father touched his head to mine. Dear boy, he said, I will come again. That is a promise. Willie Lincoln.
Now, that is wonderful. And just hearing you read that, that just sort of added this whole new dimension of when I read that.
Well, I have never read that aloud before, so that was kind of fun.
Wow. Why were you so interested in the death of Abraham Lincoln's son, Willie, and the story that Lincoln apparently went to the crypt to hold his dead son's body?
You know, it's one of those funny things in art. At the highest levels, there's often not a reason. I don't really know why. I heard the story back in the 90s. Kind of thought, oh, yeah, that's weird and cool. It's not for me to write. It's not really in my wheelhouse. And I just kept trying to put it aside over the next 20 years, and it just kept coming back as an interesting, beautiful moment. And finally, I thought, well, if something is that insistent, and if your reaction to it is always a kind of terrified revulsion, like, oh, my God, I could not write that book, you know, that might be a way to kind of lead yourself to higher artistic ground to finally sort of man up and say, okay, if it's that hard, I'm going to take a run at it.
So what was it about that anecdote, this whole notion of Lincoln visiting the dead son, that got you so much?
Well, partly on one level, it was just the idea that he could actually do that. He could leave the White House alone, could make his way across D.C., I presume on a horse, because every so often he'd go to a soldier's home on a horse, that no one would object, nobody would know about it. But then at a deeper level, I think it was just that as a father at that time of little kids— just thinking, God, you know, if you had that unimaginable loss, what options would be available to you? And kind of intrigued that that would be the choice. And I could understand it, the idea to go back to the physical body, just to be reminded of who that person was and so on. And actually, in the long term, what intrigued me was this. I could kind of understand why he would go there. But the question was, why would he stop going there? Because in the newspapers, it said he'd been there several times on several occasions. So what happens on the night when he says, okay, this is not helpful or is somehow negative? But what really intrigued me was really just the image. When I first heard that story, this image of kind of a combo of the Lincoln Memorial and the Pieta, you know, this idea of Lincoln with the body across the lap. And now after the fact, I can make these kind of intellectual rationales, but it was really just that image kept coming into my mind.
Yeah. So here you've taken this fascinating historical anecdote, this little glimpse into the real Abe Lincoln, and you've basically turned it into a ghost story. You've imagined Willie Lincoln suspended in the afterlife in some sort of purgatory with lots of ghosts arguing over the fate of his soul.
Yes.
Kind of a wild premise, I have to say.
One of the reasons I love writing is that you start with a simple idea, which is, okay, Lincoln goes into the graveyard one night. And then as you struggle to narrate that in a way that isn't common or banal or a way that doesn't undercut the real emotion of it, you find yourself going off into strange areas. So for example, here, when I first thought of the idea, you're kind of looking at 300 pages of internal monologue from Lincoln, which was daunting, you know, I didn't want to do it. So then you think, okay, well, how else can I do this? And just in your attempt not to kind of be sucky, you start getting innovative. It sounds kind of comical, but when I ask myself who else would be in a graveyard at night, well, it could be a gravedigger working overtime, or it could be these supernatural beings. So it was fun. Having the goal of just trying to do justice to this emotional moment sent me out in a lot of really interesting technical areas I wouldn't have anticipated going into.
Well, I have to say, I have never read a novel like this before. I mean, you don't just have a few ghosts. You have a whole chorus of ghosts that they gossip and they bicker with each other. Some are very eloquent. Others are bawdy and practically sort of lurking in the gutter. And the way you structure the novel is really unusual. I mean, you keep sort of cutting back and forth between the comments of what your various characters are saying. I mean, it's like you would read a play, except this is a novel, I think.
Yeah, no, that's right. It was kind of a really great five-year adventure because the book seemed to have a mind of its own. It had a kind of an underdesign that my own kind of mediocrity kept trying to suppress. But the book was very willful, and it would say, this is what we're going to do. I've heard writers talk about this before, but it's never happened to me before. But the book was literally kind of leading me. And I found myself kind of reporting to the writing desk with a little bit of sometimes trepidation, but also really anticipation. Like, what are you going to make me do today that I wouldn't normally do? So it was really the kind of book when you're young, you hope will find you someday, you know, that kind of yanks you out of your usual way of thinking about things and really challenge you to go in new directions.
Wow. So we should also mention that the audiobook that's been made of your novel includes a lot of different voices, including a bunch of famous actors. Now, don't you have a different actor for every character in the book?
Yeah, I think Random House is actually applying for a Guinness Book of World Records. It's 166 separate voices.
Wow.
So there's no doubling. And we used amazing Hollywood A-listers, and we also used a bunch of people from Random House and my agency. We used my mom, my dad, my friends. It was really a stretch to get that many people.
I will be brief. Jane Ellis.
I doubt it.
Mrs. Abigail Blass.
Mrs. Blass, please, everyone will get a...
Once at the Christmastide, Papa took us to a wonderful village festival. Ugh.
Please don't crowd. Simply stay in line. All will be accommodated.
She yips and yips and must always be first in all things. How? Please tell me, does she merit such...
You could learn a thing or two from her, Mrs. Blass. Look at her posture.
How calm she remains.
How clean her clothing is kept.
Now, there's also a metaphysics to your novel, Lincoln in the Bardo. I mean, the Bardo is, as I understand it, a part of the Tibetan Buddhist version of the afterlife, right?
Right. Yeah, I mean, Bardo actually in Tibetan means transitional state. So there are several Bardos. I mean, we're in one right now. We're in the transitional state between birth and death. And so the Bardo of the book sort of is the one that goes from the instant of your death to the instant of your next birth. I mean, in a sense, it's maybe analogous to purgatory, although it's more driven by the user, you could say. Like the person who goes to the Bardo can get out if he or she is just willing to kind of face the music, particularly the music of their own habituation, you know, the thing that they brought forward from life that's not allowing them to go on to the next step.
So the danger of the Bardo is you can get stuck there. You can sort of be trapped there for eternity.
Yeah, and then that's probably more true of my Bardo than the actual Tibetan Bardo. But at some point, I kind of had to break from it and make a whole new concept of what might happen when we die. Mainly because my guess is, not having done it, but my guess is that whatever happens is going to be a real shocker, you know. and it's not going to be like, oh, this is just what we were told. So that was part of the writing challenge, was to make a Bardo that had some resemblance to what we think the afterlife might be, but be different enough that we shared in some of that disorientation that an actual dead person would feel.
Does this resonate for you personally? I mean, as more than just a literary device, but I mean, sort of the Buddhist concept of the bardo?
Oh, yeah. My wife and I have been students of Buddhism for a while. I'm just, you know, a total beginner, but it back and flex this life in this sense. If the idea is that when you die, your mind is basically like a wild horse that gets let off the tether because now it's not dampened by your physical body anymore. And the mind in that state, they say, can do anything. It can travel. It can be omniscient. It can experience horrible visions or beautiful visions, much like our idea of heaven. Well, if that's the case, the way we cultivate and train our minds right now is really key. So, you know, you could see it as a literal afterlife, or if that doesn't suit you, you could see it as a metaphor for the fact that we're making heaven and hell this instant by our habits of mind. And then the kind of hopeful thing, which is that you theoretically could cultivate a state of mind that was more patient and more loving and more sane than the one you happen to be in at the moment. For me, that's kind of the big takeaway, is that heaven and hell are right now, and they're not beyond our ability to influence.
It seems like there's also a connection to be made between literature and religion. They're both exercises in world building. And even if you see religion as representing an underlying reality, they're both ultimately imaginative exercises.
Yes, they are. You know, I think in world building, especially in a book like this, which is you get to decide what the rules of ghosts are. You get to build them. And what was interesting to me was I didn't start off with a bunch of rules. I just started out with trying to make interesting lines in the book, basically, and fun dialogue or vivid images. And what's interesting is as you do this kind of iterative approach with the thousands of drafts, the world starts, first of all, it starts being very consistent. You can see which rules have to apply. And then the really magical thing was that, you know, about year three, with the rules in place, the rules started kind of producing weird fruit. You know, there would be turns in the plot that I hadn't anticipated that were really meaningful and I found really moving that weren't really me doing it. It was the rules of the world saying, well, if A, therefore B. It's kind of a cliche, but I've heard writers say, you know, you're like a midwife. The book is there, a perfect being or, you know, a very good being. It has a strong sense of what it is. And your job is to kind of manage your daily activities so as not to thwart the thing's individuality. And I had that feeling really strongly in the last third of the book, and it was just deeply enjoyable. I really kind of miss it. I have to now get out of 1862 and come back to now.
George Saunders' new novel, his first, is called Lincoln in the Bardo, and he was talking with Steve Paulson. Coming up...
Until now, I have told you of things that have happened in the past, things that happened a long time ago. Now I shall tell you of the days to come. I shall tell you how it will end, and then how it will begin once more. These are dark days I will tell you of, dark days and hidden things concerning the ends of the earth and the death of the gods. Listen, and you will learn.
Neil Gaiman on The End of the World, next. I'm Anne Strainchamps. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio, NPRX. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Anne Strainchamps, and Neil Gaiman gives us the end of the world today. The story of Ragnarok from Norse mythology. Neil's been writing about the Norse gods for years, most famously in his novel American Gods. But now he's gone back to the original myths and retold them. So why don't we start with the end of everything?
This is how we will know that the end times are upon us. It will be far from the age of the gods, in the time of men. It will begin with the winter. This will not be a normal winter. There will be snow driving in from all directions. Fierce winds and cold, colder than you have ever imagined cold could be. An icy cold so cold your lungs will ache when you breathe, so cold that the tears in your eyes will freeze. There will be no spring to relieve it, no summer, no autumn, only winter followed by winter followed by winter. People will be hungry, and they will be cold, and they will be angry. Great battles will take place all across the world. Brothers will fight brothers, fathers will kill sons. Mothers and daughters will be set against each other. Sisters will fall in battle with sisters and will watch their children murder each other in their turn. Twilight will come to the world, and the places where the humans live will fall into ruins, flaming briefly, then crashing down and crumbling into ash and devastation. Then, there will come the time of the great earthquakes. The mountains will shake and crumble. Trees will fall, and any remaining places where people live will be destroyed. The earthquakes will be so great that all bonds and shackles and fetters will be destroyed. All of them. Fenrir, the great wolf, will free himself from his shackles. His mouth will gape. His upper jaw will reach the heavens. His lower jaw will touch the earth. There is nothing he cannot eat, nothing he will not destroy. Flames come from his eyes and his nostrils. Where Fenris Wolf walks, flaming destruction follows. There will be flooding, too, as the seas rise and surge onto the land. Jormungandr, the Midgard serpent, huge and dangerous, will writhe in its fury closer and closer to the land. The venom from its fangs will spill into the water, poisoning all the sea life. The rotted corpses of fish and of whales, of seals and sea monsters, will wash in the waves. All who see the brothers, Fenrir the wolf and the Midgard serpent, will know death. That is the beginning of the end.
That's just the beginning?
That's just the beginning. It gets worse, actually.
What was it like to write that?
It was glorious. Writing Norse mythology, retelling Norse mythology, you feel like everything is heading there. Everything seems to be defined by Ragnarok. It's this inevitable darkness.
There's something that also seems familiar about this to contemporary ears. I don't know, I mean, partly you can hear echoes of the Game of Thrones, winter is coming, but what else?
I think, yes, they get reinterpreted to us in Walking Dead, Game of Thrones. They've all drawn a little bit on Ragnarok, but I think there's also, certainly amongst a lot of us right now, you look around and you go, oh, we are all doomed. You know, you've got, on the one hand, scientists saying global warming is a very real thing, and then we have, on the other hand, politicians going, no, it's merely a plot by the Chinese to get us to stop building things. And the feeling, I think, politically, that things are going to hell in a handbucket, and not just in America, but internationally. We are definitely entering brother against brother times, and I think that speaks to us as well.
Mm. One of the things I hear in the Ragnarok story, and especially as you've retold it, is an undernote of almost glee. Maybe it's partly channeling kind of this subconscious human desire to just destroy everything, transform it all.
It's that human desire to have that big fight.
It's the thing that sends people to war. It's that thing that goes, you know, maybe we can just, if we just hit each other, just bomb each other, just burn things, just fight, maybe that will somehow fix everything.
So you read the Norse myths first as a boy. That's what you'd say in the foreword. And they just have stuck with you. I mean, you've drawn on them. You know, they're the well that you've drawn on in so much of your work. Why do you think that is, this particular mythic cycle? I mean, there are others.
The gods of Asgard stuck with me. I was fond of the Greek and Roman gods and stuff, but there was something very godlike about them. What's joyful about the Norse gods is they are not perfect. They're screw-ups. And they are glorious screw-ups. And you really wouldn't, you know, Odin, the king of the gods, is not mighty and noble and casting thunderbolts. He is much more likely to show up in disguise at your door some night and sleep with your daughter and take your most valuable things away with you as he leaves.
It seems to me that there are two different kinds of things going on. Myths exist at one level as primal, wonderful stories. They wouldn't have existed if people didn't want to tell them and retell them and retell them. And at the same time, these are myths that channel archetypes, that tell us things about, you know, hint at larger story structures that we live inside and that we recreate over and over again. Am I overstating things? Because I think that's the value of myth.
I don't think you're overstating things at all. I think there is a process we go through as human beings where things begin as sacred mysteries and rites. And then as you start to fall away from that, you get myths, which is sort of the second stage. And then if you wait a bit longer, they've sort of devolved to fairy tales. And now it's a Disney film.
Well, which brings us to the question of, can you get the mystery back? I feel like that's what you did with American Gods. You know, you took these old stories that you'd been marinating in since you were a child that had really shaped your imagination, and you woke them up again and set those gods walking on American back roads. Was that part of, for you, wanting to recapture some of that mystery again?
Absolutely. I mean, in American Gods, I was newly come to America, and I wanted to write about what it was like to be an immigrant. And I also had all these gods in my head and thought, well, what would it be like if all of the people who came to America had brought their gods with them and then abandoned them to get on as best they could? And it's been very, very strange for me recently watching, they're making it into a television series.
Mm-hmm.
So watching the first season and going, this is that thing that I made up and now it's real.
Was that weird going back to? Because you were very involved in making the TV series. Was it weird going back to something you wrote so long ago?
Yes. Very, very weird, because it felt like things that I wrote 17 years ago seemed even more timely now.
Like what?
Like I was watching one sequence last night, an Arabic seller of gewgaws in New York falls in love with a taxi driver who happens to be a genie. It seems somehow even stranger and more fitting now to have this on our screens than when I was writing this 17 years ago. But also the idea of politics as a giant con trick, of the confidence tricks that run all the way through American Gods seem to echo huge on the screen now.
Do you read current events mythically at all? Do you pick up the newspaper and go, oh yeah, I kind of recognize that?
I try not to, because I think that way lies madness. But it can be absolutely fascinating sometimes. A few years ago, I did a retelling of Hansel and Gretel. And what impelled me to go and do Hansel and Gretel was going to the Syrian refugee camps and meeting refugees and talking to them. Families who had left Syria because there was nothing to eat. nobody's in the fields because there are landmines and you can get shot at. And now you're eating leaves and they get permission from their imam to eat cats and dogs. But now they're running out of cats and dogs. And I thought, this is Hansel and Gretel. I can tell it now.
See, you said that seeing those myths repeat themselves, that way madness lies. I guess I think maybe there's something comforting in it. You know, in Hansel and Gretel, the witch gets defeated. I guess that's what I meant about feeling like there's something profoundly hopeful about trying to see the world through the lens of the mythic imagination.
When I wrote Coraline many years ago, my children's book, I began it with a misquotation from G.K. Chesterton, although he said something similar. But the quote that Coraline begins with is that fairy tales are not true, they are more than true, not because they tell us that dragons exist, but because they tell us that dragons can be defeated.
Yeah, there's a funny moral message at the end of the Norse myths. Ragnarok is the end of the world, but there's a new beginning. The gods have died, but the memory of them remains. You can say it's about the death of the world. It's also about the death of each of us individually. Every generation dies, and it's the children who will, you know, carry on.
Exactly. Ragnarok for each of us, Armageddon for each of us, is very real. We're all living in the last days. We get maybe 100 years. But the children pick it up and carry on, and it's our job to give them the best world we can. That is the end. But there is also what will come after the end. From the grey waters of the ocean, the green earth will arise once more. The sun will have been eaten, but the sun's daughter will shine in the place of her mother, shine with young light and new. The woman and the man, life and life's yearning, will come out from inside the ash tree that holds the worlds together. They will feed upon the dew on the green earth, and they will make love. And from their love will spring mankind.
Neil Gaiman reading from his new book, Norse Mythology. And that's it for this hour. To the Best of Our Knowledge comes to you from Wisconsin Public Radio. Doug Gordon produced this show, along with Charles Monroe Kane, Raymond Tangekar, and Mark Rickers. The technical director for To the Best of Our Knowledge is Joe Hartke. Steve Paulson is our executive producer, and I'm Anne Strainchamps. Thanks for listening.